Okay, let's dive deep into money velocity today.
Yeah.
We're talking about how quickly money actually circulates through the economy.
Right.
And specifically, why the old way we tracked it, M1 velocity, is kind of broken now, analytically
Yeah,
speaking.
that's a key point.
So our mission is really to focus on the more reliable measure, M2 velocity, and figure out, what's it telling us about potential systemic risks right now?
Exactly. Velocity is, well, it's crucial because it gives us a window into economic psychology.
Psychology, okay.
Yeah. You basically take the total size of the economy, that's your nominal GDP or PY, and you divide it by the amount of money out there, M.
Right, the classic MVPY, solve for V.
Precisely. And that ratio, V, it tells you the average number of times each dollar changes hands in a given period. It's really a measure of spending urgency versus the desire to just hold on to cash.
So high velocity means money's moving fast, low velocity means it's kind of sitting there.
You got it. But we need to be really careful about which M, which measure of money supply we use. And that's where the M1 problem comes in. The issue really stems from 2020 when the Federal Reserve changed Regulation D.
Regulation D, remind me.
That was the rule limiting certain withdrawals from savings accounts to 6 per month. They just eliminated that limit.
Wait, hold on. So they effectively just said savings accounts can work exactly like checking accounts. No restrictions.
Pretty much, yeah. Functionally, the distinction blurred overnight.
Wow. Okay. So that must have instantly like shattered the meaning of M1, right? Because
Yeah.
M1 was supposed to be just the super liquid, immediately spendable cash.
It did. It completely distorted the M1 series. Then, in 2021, the Fed officially redefined M1 to include savings deposits, and they backdated that change to May 2020.
The retroactive change.
Right, and that created this massive artificial spike in the M1 data. Like $11.2 trillion jumped in almost instantly.
So comparing M1 velocity from before 2020 to today is pointless.
It's analytically unsound. You just can't do it reliably. But, and this is the interesting part, M2 already included those savings deposits.
Ah, okay. So M2 was consistent through that whole redefinition chaos.
Exactly, which makes M2 velocity, M2V, the only consistent long-term velocity metric we really have left to analyze historical trends.
Okay, so let's use M2V then. Tell us the story through its lens, because the history sounds dramatic. What was the peak?
Oh, the peak was something else. Q3 1997, M2V hit 2.192. That was its all-time high.
1997. Peak.com bubble territory, right? Irrational exuberance.
Absolutely. People felt incredibly optimistic, consumer spending was strong, and crucially, the perceived opportunity cost of holding idle cash felt enormous. You felt like you had to spend it or invest it immediately.
The hot potato effect. Get rid of the cash.
Precisely. Now contrast that with the absolute opposite extreme, the all-time trough, Q2 2020.
The pandemic hit.
Right, M2V just plummeted to 1.130. It was a perfect storm,
Oh,
really.
drove it down so hard.
Two main things. First, you had forced reductions in transactions because of lockdowns. People literally couldn't spend even if they wanted to.
Makes sense.
But second, and maybe more importantly from a psychological view, was this massive wave of precautionary cash hoarding, a flight to safety. Everyone wanted cash.
And huge stimulus checks were hitting accounts too, right? Inflating M2 itself.
Exactly. So M2 ballooned while GDP was constrained, and people actively wanted to hold more cash relative to their income. There's actually an alternative way to write the equation, the Cambridge K version.
Right, MOBPY.
Yeah. It shows that when people's desire to hold cash as a proportion of their income, that's goes way up, velocity, which is 1K basically, has to collapse. Q2 2020 was peak K.
That really paints a picture. So if velocity is like this big confidence gauge, how does that play out on, Main Street for actual businesses?
Oh, it has a huge impact. It really dictates winners and losers in retail.
How so?
Well, think about it. When velocity is high, like in 97, people feel confident, they're spending freely. That environment really favors discretionary
Like
retailers.
electronic stores, furniture places, big ticket items.
Exactly. Think Best Buy, places where people make larger non-essential purchases, maybe even taking on a bit of debt because they feel secure about the future.
Okay. And low velocity.
Low velocity signals the opposite. Anxiety, price sensitivity, people hoarding cash, that strongly favors the value-oriented giants.
Walmart, Costco,
Yeah.
the everyday low price guy.
Right. When consumers get nervous, they trade down, price becomes paramount. So the discount retail model is actually countercyclical to velocity. It thrives when velocity is low.
That's a really clear divide. Okay, so bringing it to today, this is where it gets a bit concerning, right?
Yeah.
What's the current setup?
It is precarious. We've got a few things happening at once. First, the M2 money supply itself is actually contracting. It's shrinking.
Which is pretty rare historically. That's the Fed's quantitative tightening, QT, draining liquidity.
That's the main driver, yes. Plus, you have restrictive interest rates, and nominal GDP growth, while still positive, is decelerating. It's slowing down.
Okay, contracting M2, slowing in GDP. Okay, so let's go back to the equation. V in GDP M2, what happens?
Well, this is the critical point. If M2, the denominator, shrinks faster than NGDP, the numerator, slows down, what has to happen to V? Velocity.
Mathematically.
Yeah.
It has to increase.
It has to. There's no other way for the equation to balance.
But wait, that sounds wrong. An increase in velocity now wouldn't feel like 1997 confidence, would it? It feels like something else entirely.
It absolutely would not signal economic health. This is what we're calling the rupture risk.
Rupture risk. Okay, explain that.
A forced, sharp increase in velocity under these conditions, shrinking money supply, slowing growth, it would be a symptom of severe systemic stress.
Meaning
the shrinking pool of money is having to change hands faster out of sheer necessity, desperately trying to support the existing level of economic activity, even as that activity slows. It's like everyone is scrambling for the remaining liquidity.
So it's not willing spending, it's forced churning.
Kind of, yeah. And if velocity can't spike fast enough to compensate for the shrinking M2 relative to NGDP, well, the only mathematical alternative is that NGDP itself has to contract sharply.
Which means recession.
It's a sign the system is under duress, struggling to function with less liquidity.
Wow. Okay, that paints a stark picture. Uh-huh. The clear takeaway seems to be about managing liquidity carefully, especially for businesses right now.
Absolutely. Contingency funding plans, stress testing liquidity sources, that becomes paramount.
So we've kind of defined this danger, this rupture risk. Let me leave you, the listener, with a final thought to chew on. If a forced spike in velocity isn't a sign of health, but actually a flashing red light for financial instability, then maybe how much more focus should policymakers and, frankly, corporate leaders put on tools designed to head off that instability before we get anywhere near that rupture point? Things like, say, the countercyclical capital buffer for banks, designed specifically to build resilience when times are good, to prepare for stresses like this. Just something to consider.